ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, your weekly entree to the best new books and writing. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. And, well, sometimes they're not the best, Kate, let's be honest. But, well, we are honest about that.
Well, we're trying. We're giving you some options anyway, dear listeners. This week, a few variations on how to tell the story of a life.
And what it means to use fiction or auto-fiction memoir to do it. Debut novelist Sam Sussman's book, Boy from the North Country, is one of the books we're talking about today.
And a writer who has spent decades resisting the call of memoir but has finally succumbed, not without a fight, it has to be said. That's the Canadian grand dame of literature, Margaret Atwood.
But also a novel shaped by a particular wind, a wind with a name.
The wind is called Helm, and it blasts its way through the very north of England in the latest novel by Sarah Hall.
Okay, well, before we get blown away, Kate, let's welcome our guests to The Bookshelf, music writer Stuart Coop and novelist Hannah Kent. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Lovely to have you both. Well, let's spell out your publishing lives in a bit more detail, and we'll talk about your latest works too. So, Hannah, you're a novelist and memoirist whose books include Burial Rites, The Good People, Devotion, and most recently, Always Home, Always Homesick, A Love Letter to Iceland. Now, that's a memoir that gives us the backstory to your first novel, Burial Rites. But it's more than that, I guess, isn't it? So what did you want to do with this latest book of yours?
It's a funny thing. Much like Atwood, I remember telling friends that I would never, ever write a memoir because I simply didn't think my life was interesting enough. She's managed to hold out for far longer than I did. I've clearly given in. But I think I reached a time in my life where I had started reflecting on my early years and especially my time in Iceland and how a year away spent on exchange really turned me not only into a writer and gave me the basis of my first novel, but also really shaped me as a person. So it was conceived of really during COVID lockdown, as I think probably many books. And, you know, there was a lot of introspection going on during those months. And that's really where it came from, this idea that, oh, OK, maybe this is interesting. Maybe I do have something to say.
Remind us how old you were when you first went to Iceland.
I was 17. I had finished high school and during that final year had found myself paralysed really by indecision as to what to do next. I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I felt compelled to pursue something which seemed, I guess, more vocationally stable. And really as a deferral tactic, when an opportunity came up to apply for a Rotary exchange abroad, I applied for it with not really any great sense of where I wanted to go. And I ended up in a very small village called Sørðakrókur in the north of Iceland, and it was there really that I both decided that yes, absolutely, I should become a writer. I should try to do this for as long as possible. And also, I think, you know, really developed into the adult I am today.
Yes, and you wrote this incredible book called Burial Rites, which told the story, the true story, of the last woman executed in Iceland. And it was an international sensation, and your career just, you know, exploded from there. So looking back at that now, what have you seen? What's that process been like?
This is the funny thing. When you look back over 20 years, things take on pattern, and it's very easy to read a lot of kismet and fate into all the various things which happened to us. But certainly, I think a great deal of this memoir came from a desire to express gratitude to the Icelandic people and Icelandic history and Icelandic culture. I mean, the country is such an incredible place for writers and readers. I think they continue to publish more books per capita than anywhere else in the world. And so much of writing the memoir was a chance for me to acknowledge just how much of my own creativity has been shaped by that place. You know, it's not coming from within as much as I would like to think it is. It's really been informed by my experiences there.
Now, Stuart Coupe, you write about music. You have a couple of radio shows about music and you've promoted artists, musicians and put out or produced some great albums. Some of them are my favourites. You've also been writing these books, Roadies, The Secret History of Australian Rock and Roll, the memoir Shake Some Action, My Life in Music and Other Stuff, and most recently, Saffron Incorporated, the first King of the Cross and 50 years of sex, murder, music and mayhem.
Yep.
Amazing. Why did you want to go? Because it's Abe Saffron is a what they call a colourful Sydney identity. For people who haven't come across his name, who was he and why did you want to write about him?
You know, when I'm explaining to people who don't know the name Abe Saffron, I kind of go think Al Capone, you know, an Australian, quite specifically King's Cross version of that. You know, Abe Saffron was the guy who sort of ruled the entertainment precinct of King's Cross for, since the 1950s through to the, you know, he died in 2006. Why did I want to write about him? I didn't want to write another rock and roll biography. You know, there wasn't a subject that interested me enough. I wanted to challenge myself to write a book about someone who I'd never met to see if I could, you know, by research and thinking, you know, get my interpretation of Abe Saffron. And I also wanted to have myself as a little backdrop. I mean, I moved to Sydney in August of 1978 and I lived briefly in the Cross and spent a lot of time during the 80s, particularly going to gigs there, misbehaving completely, going to the Siebel Townhouse to every second day to interview a visiting rock star. You know, the King's Cross and those environs of Potts Point and Woolloomooloo, so forth, were rock and roll central in those days. And it sort of struck me that I was hell-bent on a life of sex, drugs and rock and roll, but lurking around me were the likes of Abe Saffron and these other nefarious characters. And I also was a little tired of hearing Saffron's name connected with a whole number of significant Australian events, particularly the disappearance and presumed murder of Juanita Nielsen and the hideous fires at Luna Park. You know, having finished the book, you know, I'm completely convinced that he had virtually nothing to do with the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen, and I think that he probably had very little, if anything, to do with the fire at Luna Park. So I wanted to explore those things because people, they mention Luna Park fires, they go Abe Saffron. They mention Juanita Nielsen, they go Abe Saffron. And I went, I'm not sure about this. Let's have a read and find it, and let's do some research and let's have a think.
But he did have connections in the highest of places as well as the lowest.
Oh, look, you know, he was a masterful controller and manipulator of people. So his phone book, which was swiped once when he was coming back into Australia, you know, had the names of judges and senior police and politicians, all sorts of people that were either on his payroll, scared of him. You know, there was the constant threat of blackmail that kept a lot of them under control. Saffron was a smart individual. You know, he may have had a dark heart, but he managed to, you know, not get done for anything. He did a brief stint in jail towards the end of his life for tax evasion. But otherwise, you know, he went uncharged with anything. And that, yes, look, that had a lot to do with his connections. It had a lot to do with the fact that he didn't walk around King's Cross looking like Tony Soprano. You know, he kept his head down. He kept invisible. He knew his power. He wasn't ostentatious about it. There wasn't the big cigar and look at me, I'm the guy who runs the Cross, like some people that have come afterwards. You know, he just went about really acquiring real estate, you know, at the height of his influence. Louis Nara told me recently that he owned 57 properties in and around King's Cross. That's a lot of real estate.
Well, one of the Sydney characters that definitely deserves the Coupe treatment, Abe Saffron. Find that book. It's called Saffron Incorporated.
But, Stuart, as you said, you're also a music writer. You've written a number of music biographies. You mentioned there that you have interviewed all sorts of international performers. Now, here's a question that's relevant to the book that you and Cassie have read together. Did you ever interview or have much to do with Bob Dylan?
Yes. I've interviewed Dylan twice, which may make me the, I'm not sure, but it may make me the only Australian to interview him twice. But I spoke to him in person in 1986 when he was touring with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and then on the telephone in 1992. So I've had two encounters with his Bobness, and particularly the one that I remember most, as you do, when you're sitting in a bar at 2 a.m. in the morning in Auckland in New Zealand, and there are three people at the table. One is the legendary manager, Elliot Roberts. One of those people is you, and the other pint-sized little figure at the table is Bob Dylan. So it tends to stay in your memory.
What an extraordinary thing to do, Stuart, and there's a whole lot of reasons that we're going to talk more about his Bobness. Hannah Kent, are you a Bob Dylan fan?
I quite like Bob Dylan. I feel that I haven't listened to enough of him, except actually for when I was in Iceland, because one of my host fathers was a mad, mad fan. And the only thing he would ever listen to, not radio, you know, wouldn't even put the television on, was Bob. So that was really the first point that I encountered his music. But I think growing up, I think I was fed a lot more Led Zeppelin and Joni Mitchell as a kid. That was probably where I came from. But yeah, a massive, I still nonetheless can appreciate him as the figure he is, as the titan he is of music. Music, particularly folk music.
Well, Hannah, you and I are going to sit back for a bit before we get to Sarah Hall's novel Helm and Cassie. So it looks like you and Stuart are going to talk to us about the novel The Boy from the North Country.
Well, Stuart, I was thinking about 2016 while I was reading this book, which was the year that Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And overnight, we hastily organised a conversation with you and the late, great Ian Shedden, who was a music writer for The Oz for many years, and also a colleague of ours, Mark Sutton, who wrote a PhD on Bob Dylan's lyrics. So he was feeling particularly vindicated that morning. And we had a great conversation with other listeners joining in. Each of them brought a lyric that they loved from his work. And, you know, that's just one moment in my own fandom of Bob. I grew up with parents who loved him, and I learned to love him, and I still do, and I am a great fan. Are you a fan?
I'm a complete fan. I'm not a lover of everything that Dylan has done. I mean, I shy away from saying terrible records, because they may be records that mean, you know, a lot to other people, but there are certainly a lot of Bob Dylan albums that don't move me at all.
But there's a lot of albums.
There's a lot of records.
Well, like, you know, 45, 46 or something?
At least, I think. I'm currently working my way through the new bootleg series, volume, I think it's 18, which is all the very, very, very formative Bob Dylan recordings, which is pretty remarkable just to hear Dylan's growth and where he came from. You know, I struggled for a long time with, you know, Christian Bob, Gospel Bob. I'm warming to, you know, Gospel Bob. But, you know, at his best, you know, Blonde on Blonde, Highway 61, Time Out of Mind, you know, we could go. John Wesley Harding still remains probably my most played Bob Dylan record. Do you want to go on? We could talk about this for the whole show.
Yeah, I know, we could. But Blood on the Tracks, I guess you'd have to put
well,
it in there.
I figure we're going to get to Blood on the Tracks.
Which is one of the albums that comes up in this novel. It is a novel, that's important to say, but it has a backstory in an article that this author, Sam Sussman, wrote for Harper's in 2021. And it told his personal story of growing up, and slowly as he became a teen and a young man, people just started to tell him he looked like Bob Dylan. In fact, a teacher he had emailed him in the middle of the night. He'd just been watching a documentary and said, "You've got to check this musician Bob Dylan out because you just look so much like him." So he became a big fan of Dylan too, this young kid. And then he began to realise that it wasn't just a coincidence that he looked like Bob Dylan.
No, he started to delve, into his, his upbringing, but particularly his mother's relationship with Dylan. And I must admit, reading this book, you know, it made me think about that line between a novel and a memoir, because I'm going, okay, this is a novel, but I started checking name references and I started checking, did the Bob Dylan concert that he went to with his mum, you know, actually happen at the time that it did? Is, you know, this particular character a real person? And I was starting to wrestle with the, you know, where is this coming from? This to me reads like a memoir, and I'm trying to work out where the, you know, the fictional component is.
I had the reverse experience.
Ah, right.
Because I had read the article and the articles that came out when this book came out a little earlier in the year in America. Then when I began to read the book itself, I thought, have we got a James Frey here? Is this a complete fiction? Has he utterly made this fantasist's story up? Like, I did entertain that quite seriously for some time.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, we sort of don't know. I mean, he does, you know, absolutely look like Bob Dylan. So many people told him, you know, as you mentioned. And then when he started talking with his mother, who I think is really the essence of this book, you know, after a while, I love the Dylan almost backstory, but the relationship between son and mother as she goes through cancer, you know, is quite extraordinary. But as it turns out, his mother was living in New York City. She was studying acting with Stella Adler, but then she moved on to study painting with Norman Raybon. Now, I had to go to my Dylan books to check that Norman Raybon was a real, very influential painter.
Yeah, he was a Ukrainian refugee who'd come to America and was very much influenced by the early 20th century European painters and total purist about painting.
Yeah, and very confronting with his students, and that's rubbish, and going up and painting all over their painting. So Mrs. Sussman, you know, is studying with him, and one day this, you know, down and out looking dude walks in and goes over into the corner and joins the painting class, and this is Bob Dylan.
Mm. There's a ripple goes through the class because people recognise him.
Well, it's mid-70s Bob Dylan. So
he's been famous for you know, more than a decade, so or you know, several decades.
So as we find out, you know, this was the time when Dylan was writing the songs that appeared on Blood on the Tracks. He did, if we believe the narrative of Boy from the North Country, have an ongoing, off-and-on relationship.
But let's just go back to how this unfolds. So as a young man, his mother has a series of partners. His father, Simon, who separated from his mother when he was two years old, is long gone and has other children, and there's a real sense of abandonment about that. And other men have come and gone from her life. They live in this bucolic farm in a place called Goshen up in New York State, the Hudson Valley, very beautiful. You know, she makes jumpers, hand-knits jumpers for him, and they have cows and, you know, lovely life there. But these men come and go. Then one of them, he's well into his obsession with Bob Dylan, after all these people have said that he looks like him, and he's been listening to the music on his headphones. And one of these men, Luke,
yes,
says, oh, you know your mother knew him. And he says, what? He says, yeah, she knew him when she was younger. And he starts to think, my gosh, you know, that's amazing. Why hasn't she ever said anything about it? And slowly we begin to learn a little bit more about her early life in, as you say, the 70s in this apartment that she had, run-down apartment, rent-controlled apartment in New York, where she's trying to be an actress and doing painting and waitressing on the side. And, yeah, they had this, well, at least a year-long affair. He was married to Sarah at the time, had a couple of other people probably on the go. But then this character, Sam Sussman, or Evan, as he's known in the book, does the dates and they don't match up.
Except that then he discovers that his mother met up with Dylan again, and little Evan stroke Sam appeared roughly 9 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets him really thinking. Mm. And also, as you mentioned, you know, Mum had a succession of really, it seems, unfortunate and unpleasant, particularly with Luke, which was a violent, you know, he was a violent individual, which was the reason that that relationship ended. And so Sam spent all of these years thinking about, you know, who's his dad, the sense of, you know, fatherhood, because he's had these men come into his life as father figures.
Yes.
And then he's become comfortable with them, you know, particularly Luke, I sensed, and then they disappear. And so that compounds his sense of, well, you know, who is my, you know, my real father? You know, is it...
But the mother won't confirm either way.
No. And so...
And so, yeah, it's entirely possible that Simon, who left when he was two, really is his biological father.
So that's what I want to ask you both about how the book is structured. So is this an adult man dealing with his adult mother's memories and trying to make sense of it? Like, how is it structured?
Yeah, so the structure is he comes to the door of the farm. He's been called home. He's been living and studying in the UK at Oxford. He's trying to be a writer and been living there. He's 26 years old, and his mother's called him home because she's being diagnosed with cancer. And she's actually hidden how long she's known. And he opens the door, and she opens the door, and she's very unwell. So he begins helping her. He takes her to a chemotherapy session.
Yeah, and most of it is told through the viewpoint of Evan, but then at certain times in the narrative it flips back to his mother talking and ruminating about her life.
Yes, did you like that?
I did. I mean, once I got used to it. So, you know, she's talking about her relationship with Dylan and, you know, what it was like in the apartment and what music they listened to and what he did and when he'd disappear and when he'd come back. So I thought that worked. And through all of this, you know, is this almost detective story-like thing, you know, because you're thinking,
You just don't know.
You know, and you're turning pages going, you know, is Bob Dylan his father? But what really made the novel work for me was the way he describes the disintegration physically of his mother with the cancer.
As she undergoes the therapy.
Yeah, I mean, I've had experience of this via, you know, my partner. And so, you know, having watched one-on-one what happens with serious chemotherapy and those, you know, meetings and doctors' meetings and all of that sort of stuff, I mean, he draws that very, very movingly and very, very powerfully, I thought. And there came a point in the novel, I don't know what you thought, Cassie, where I was starting to lose a bit of interest in the Bob question, and I was really completely fixated by, you know, this astonishing woman that's his mother and the way she engages with Evan, and that became the biggest story of this book. You know, it's very, very powerful and very moving, and that kept me going. Yeah. You know, it's another's appointment, you know, and the way he captures the, you know, the abject agony that his mother is in as they're driving in cars to go to appointments, and how, you know, how she's watching her diet, how much weight she's losing, all of this stuff. It's very powerful.
I was quite inconsolable at the end of this.
Yeah.
I haven't been moved by a book in this way, well, this year, actually. And I don't think it's a perfect novel. I think there are flaws. I'm not quite sure why it had this power. A lot of it is about his abandonment and sense of abandonment, his inability to see her utter generosity when he's a child and how brilliant she is actually to have survived all the things that she did. It's a story about trauma and the long tail of abuse, whatever it is, in the past that I think they both have. And there's a real poetry in it, these recurring motifs of the coyote howling and the freight train.
He's Dylan's son. He's got to be on a ride like
that.
We don't know. You know, and also, you know, some of it, he comes across as quite maybe callous, or, you know, the moment when he forces his mother to go to the Bob Dylan concert, you know, because Bob Dylan is playing nearby where they live, and he has this thing of, if he and Mum go, Dylan's going to see them from the stage and he's going to recognise, you know, his mother. He's going to look into his eyes, into Evan's eyes, and he's going to have an epiphany on stage and all is going to be revealed. But, you know, he comes across, I guess his own preoccupation with the story and his father takes over his compassion for looking after his mother, who clearly should not have been driven all that way and taken to a Bob Dylan concert at that stage of her illness.
It is a getting of wisdom story in its most simple and most complex.
And it's so powerful. It's really I was just like you. I mean, I was just like, breathless going, wow, this for reasons again that I
they have nothing to do with Bob Dylan.
They don't. I mean, it's Evan and his and his mum.
There have been some very, very harsh reviews of this.
I read Dwight Garner in the New York Times, who basically said, well, if it wasn't for the Dylan backstory,
it wouldn't have been published.
No, and he was quite scathing of it.
Which is interesting because, I mean, the Jewish element alone is fascinating and the lore and the language and the history, the kind of capturing of the milieu, the ideas about art. There's a lot in this and it's not dressed up as an intellectual book.
Look, it's an easy but very, very powerful read. Yeah, there's lots of stuff. I mean, I was scurrying to records to have a listen to, going, hang on, let's listen to this song on Blood on the Tracks. Mm. Let's, and I spent, ages looking up Norman Raybon and all sorts of things.
Well, I did just have a little quick listen to A Girl from the North Country.
Oh, did you? Right.
Before we came here. Yeah.
And it's interesting, I also went to Clinton Halen's 2-volume biography of Dylan, where he mentions Sussman, and he doesn't dismiss this. Mm. He says, this was another claim, because the thing is, Dylan has form.
Oh, yes. We maybe should just, as we wind up, he does have many acknowledged children. I think 5 children that he acknowledges and possibly more. Who knows? We don't know. Well, it's part of the lore. It's part of the mystique of this man who has meant so much to so many people over the years.
But it was interesting when I interviewed him in 1986, I was kept waiting for a couple of hours. And I asked the promoter, what's going on? Why are we being kept waiting? And he said,
that would have been the late Michael Gudinski, was it?
It was Michael Gudinski. And Michael said to me, Dylan goes to his room every night after a concert and calls his children. And I put that in my piece that ran in the Australian newspapers. Dylan was furious with Gudinski for telling me this. I put it in because I thought, well, this is incredibly admirable. You're Bob Dylan. You do this concert in front of 25, 30,000 people. What's the most important thing for you when you get back to your hotel room? Call your kids.
Now I'm wondering,
did he call Sam, or Evan? We wonder.
Well, we don't know.
But I love the way that it's a book that is haunted by the music, and that as soon as you're talking about the book, you're also listening or re-listening or having those bits of lyrics.
We're tangled up in blue, Kate.
And that's Sam Sussman's Boy from the North Country, published by Grove Press. You're listening to ABC Radio National's weekly book review program, The Bookshelf, with me, Kate Evans, with Cassie McCullough, as always, and with guests music writer Stuart Coop and novelist Hannah Kent.
And now we're turning to the latest from the English writer Sarah Hall. She's got 7 novels and 3 short story collections to her name, including Burnt Coat, The Electric Michelangelo, and The Wolf Border, Kate.
And I loved that one, I'll confess. It was about a fictional project to rewild Britain with wolves. But look, one of the things about this new book of hers, Helm, is its specificity. So we might say that she's an English writer, but it's even more important to say she's from Cumbria in the far north of England, because this is a novel that is all about a very particular place.
Okay, so it's called Helm, and Kate, you and Hannah have read it. Why is it called Helm? I mean, is that something that's worth knowing?
Oh, yes. I mean, I said it was set in the north. It's set specifically in a place called the Eden Valley, which is not far from what's now the city of Carlisle. And it did take me a little while to work out exactly what Helm was. But, well, Helm is a phenomenon. It's a named wind. It's a wind that happens only in this part of the world. But Hannah, when you started reading it, did you understand
whose story this was?
No, I had no idea. I went into this novel completely blind. I had never heard of Helm, and completely being unaware of who or what it might be, it took me quite a few pages to sort of orient myself same. As a reader. But, you know, that said, I knew from the very first sentence that I was in safe hands and that it would be revealed to me in time. The opening line is wonderful. It starts with, "Helm doesn't know when Helm was born." And I think I just kind of went along for the ride from that moment.
Yes, I was both intrigued, I was with her, and I was slightly lost at the beginning. At first I thought Helm might have been a mountain or Helm might have been something about the landscape. And then you realise that Helm is the wind that rushes through and returns to this place. But then we move through characters in multiple time periods. We keep returning to their lives and the world as it's shaped by this wind. Now, the first who we really meet as a character, well, it's a Neanderthal story. So what has she conjured with this one, Hannah?
So we meet, I think it's Nene, that's how I was reading it to myself, who is, like you say, a Neolithic woman who I guess is something of a seer. We meet her first in childhood where she survives death almost sort of miraculously, although that wouldn't be the term they used, and sort of marks herself with scarring on her chest. And through these sort of illnesses and these sort of close, you know, these close journeys to that membrane, to the other world, to death, she starts to have these visions. And these visions sort of make her, I guess, a figure of not ridicule but suspicion in the tribe that she is then in. And sort of in her determination to fulfill, I guess, the actions that have been bestowed upon her in this vision. One of the things that she sees quite early on is that there is a stone circle which has been created by the tribe and their ancestors, which is incredibly important for them. And she has a vision which shows that the circle is incomplete, that there is a very specific stone that they will one day find which will complete the circle. And it's really when she finally decides to exclude herself from the community. She goes up, she battles this wind, which has shaped so much of the tribe's activities, what they can grow, their spirituality, their position in relation to other tribes. It's only when she goes up there and she sort of faces off against this force, against this entity, that she then returns with a third mark that she gives herself. She has survived that force. But this, the story of Nene is a wonderful one to start off with, because it's really where this idea of Helm is this animate force, not simply just weather, but also not sort of an anthropomorphic, you know, there's a real cleverness, I think, in going way back when. Because in the opening chapter too, which becomes so much of a touchstone as to how to read the next of the rest of the book, we realise that the chapters are going to introduce people situated at time, and although they are very different from one another, they are essentially a product of their time and will come together to illustrate the changing relationship between humankind and Helm over thousands of years. So it's wonderful to start with her, because I think this is a character who is intensely spiritual. She has visions. She's a seer. Her world is completely natural. She's as much of a part of the landscape as anything else. And I think this is a lovely place to begin, like I say, because as we move forward, we start to meet other characters where there's this, you know, a growing dislocation between Mother Nature, between Helm and humankind. So this was one of the narratives that I loved the most, the story of Nene, this wise woman of a Neolithic tribe.
And what we're doing is we're seeing the world in terms of a completely different cosmology. But a character which really helped me understand the book and sort of locate me in the place was the next one we met. And that's in the late medieval period. And he's a character called Michael Lang, who is, well, he's described as a sort of wizard priest and a sort of witch catcher, I guess. And he turns up in the area and basically scares the bejesus out of all the locals, because he is a figure that they've heard of. And he's there to battle with this demonic wind. And so it brings together all of the sort of religion and superstition and fear and anxiety. And he turns up with a metal skull cap slightly embedded into his head, and a young boy who's clearly been stolen as part of the Crusades. And as well as telling this story about religion, I love the way it took us into the language of the North and the words that these people use to describe the wind. I mean, he was such a menacing figure, but I was really, really taken by this story.
He was terrifying. And yet, like you say, I found those sections so compelling. I loved the scene particularly where, you know, no one ever sees him without this iron skull cap. And then there is this one scene where the young boy removes it to tend to his skull. And it's so hideous. And
scabrous.
I think,
oh
my goodness. I think Sarah Hall had so much fun with really imagining those times. And you're right. I think in all of these different narratives, she really adopts the language that she's using to describe the landscape to reflect the time and the ideology that were at play then. The last section that we hear from his is wonderful. I won't go into detail for fear of spoilers, but he ends up going up alone up the mountain, and he sort of is beset by visions and something that in the previous section was this sort of, you know, this entity, this force, this wind, which is extraordinary, which sort of speaks to us, you know, something which is so much beyond the life that we know in a day-to-day version, is suddenly rendered completely menacing. You start to see the way in which our lives are shaped by the beliefs that we form and that we're fed.
And, I mean, we won't go through all of the different periods and all of the characters that we meet, but which characters or periods particularly interested you?
I think other than the first two, like you say, we also revisit Helm. We get a lot from Helm's perspective. And I think those were probably my favourite sections throughout the novel because Helm is playful. There's such a wonderful curiosity in humans. There's a really great bit in the first section where we sort of really get to be introduced to the novel's primary concern. You know, let's see what a wind makes of the people it affects and in what ways a people may affect a wind. And I love that it ends with Helm realising that people are paying attention and thinking to itself, is this a relationship? But I think the other sections that are probably worth mentioning is probably the most contemporary one, which is when we meet Dr. Salima Sutar, who's an academic, and her field research is really around the presence of microplastic particles in the air and the ways in which these are going to be affecting the weather, that they're going to be potentially changing Helm's cloud, you know, this very iconic cloud which sort of shows that Helm is coming. And I think having her narrative specifically juxtapose those that come from a more historical time are very poignant. It's a very clever way of subtly introducing this book as a novel of climate change without, you know, beating the reader around the brow with it.
Hearing you talk about Helm, Hannah, makes me think of the second part of your book, Devotion. Were you thinking of that too?
No, I mean, I can see the connection, but I mean, I don't really think about my books once I've written them.
I do. I think about your books.
But I think definitely as a reader, I know that probably, you know, you can see what I like to read in my books. And certainly I loved this novel for its, you know, full-bodied embrace of nature and weather, but particularly the force behind both and the ways in which they change our lives, and then also the ways in which our own actions might affect. It's really a story of interconnection between nature and humanity, and I found that very, very interesting.
What about the way in which she deals with history? Because, I mean, you've written historical fiction, and that's, you have to make all these choices, don't you, about how you're going to use language and research. And there's a sense that the language of this northern part of England is embedded in it in all sorts of really interesting ways. I mean, the very particular words that people use, the landscape, the stones, the stories, and I feel like she's done it all in a really creative way.
She has. I was listening to a podcast with Sarah Hall not long ago, and she mentioned that this book essentially has taken her 20 years to write. So undoubtedly a lot of thought and reflection has gone into it. But it is incredibly parochial, both in setting and description and language. And I think that this is something which is clearly very important to her. I'm so curious as to what her research might have been like. I think she spoke with many locals. I think she seems like in some ways she was sort of an anthropologist on the ground gathering nicknames. I mean, there's lists also. Aside from these eight narratives which comprise the novel and Helm's voice, we also have this kind of other material which is shown as kind of to substantiate the variability of Helm and its importance in this particular area. And there's this fantastic list included amongst that additional material, which is just a list of all the nicknames that Helm has had over the years. And they're hilarious. They're fantastic. I don't think there is any way she could have included material like that had she not really spent a great deal of time immersing herself in essentially the folklore of this wind.
And she herself was born in Carlisle, so this is also her part of the world. And I was thinking of the fiction of Benjamin Myers as well. He wrote a book called Cuddy, which covers 1,000 years around Durham Cathedral. And there's also that sense of the very particular language and mythology and stories that you tell in a totally not straightforward way. And suddenly you've also got things like hot air balloons being buffeted by the wind. And then down below, the trains arrive. So you get a sense of moving through time, but not in a sort of obvious way.
No, and even in when she's, I mean, I love that section with the hot air balloon. That's hilarious. I would love to read a little bit of that if we have time.
Please.
But even within that section, you'll see she sort of jumps forward to the future and back. And in that, again, that first introductory chapter, there's sort of an allusion to the fact that time doesn't exist for Helm. So as much as these are very sort of historically specific sections and stories and, you know, very loyal to the language of that time, there is still this playfulness, this sense that it could all sort of collapse in upon itself, that all these times are actually pressed very closely against one another. I'll read the little section, which I loved so much, from this hot air balloon. This is, I think, in the 1800s, and Helm, it's from the perspective of Helm, and this couple have sort of lifted very close nearby in what is very clearly, in our minds, a hot air balloon. There they are, the exuberant, flamboyantly dressed couple, petting beneath a gargantuan inflammable. Helm is buoyed by the aerial company and oddly nauseated. Something about the creepy, crepey surface of the inflatable and the ooh of the balloon and the balloon itself, its potential to burst and issue forth a loud, deflationary, unfunny raspberry. Cue globophobia. Just wait. Those smaller, rubbery, plastic ones are really going to twist Helm's melons, accidentally let go of by children at parties, squeaky, sticking to hair with static and popping without warning, leaving withered, four skinny cases behind. It's all shudder-inducing.
And I just found it a bit
fantastic,
where they say the wind is so strong that it could blow eggs back up the asses of hens. So she's being quite playful and funny, as well as telling what I guess is quite a serious story about the weather and landscape. And, you know, and as you say, it is a climate change novel, but it's a whole lot of other things as well.
It is, yeah. And I really loved the playfulness in her on a prose level, but also in a lot of the stories. They are quite funny. And I suspect that this is probably one of the reasons why the novel for me never really mired itself in that bog of, you know, end times drama that can make other contemporary climate fiction novels so, you know, well, miserable. It seemed to me very funny, but at the same time, you know, incredibly relevant and important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think this is really quite an extraordinary piece of writing.
It really is.
Sarah Hall's Helm is published by Faber.
You're listening to The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National with me, Cassie McCullough, and Kate Evans. And our guests today, novelist and memoirist Hannah Kent, her memoir is Always Home, Always Homesick, a love letter to Iceland, and music writer Stuart Coop, whose memoir is Shake Some Action, My Life in Music and Other Stuff.
And what we thought we'd do is talk a little bit more about memoir, because I want to tell you about the one that I am, well, I'm 50 pages from the end. It's 600 pages long. I haven't quite finished it. But Hannah, can I just ask you quickly, was it your idea to write a memoir, or was it something other people thought you should do?
Oh, I think in the end it was, or I like to claim that it was my idea, but probably undoubtedly it's been suggested to me over the years and I just sort of fobbed it off.
Stuart, was a memoir something you always wanted to do or something other people asked you to do?
It was something that I actively resisted for an extended period of time, but I had a publisher at Penguin who thought it was a good idea, and he kept pursuing me until I decided that it was a good idea too.
The reason that I've asked you both that is that Margaret Atwood spent decades saying, no, I'm not going to write a memoir. I've got no reason to do it. I've got all my other work. Why should I do it? But at the age of 86, she finally decided that she would. And it's as funny and spiky and opinionated and also giving us really interesting insights into her work as you really might expect.
She has got the runs on the board to allow herself this little folly, I suppose. 17 novels, 17 collections of poetry, 11 works of non-fiction, 9 collections of short stories. Kate's a completist, well, almost, because she hasn't finished this memoir. But what about you, Hannah? You're a bit of a fan as well?
I'm a massive Margaret Atwood fan. I feel like probably of all the writers that I've loved, she's absolutely one who has also shaped, I guess, my attitude towards my own writing. She's absolutely someone that I aspire to. But just hearing you rattle off all those numbers, you know, it feels a bit, diminishing. But no, she's wonderful. And I love her, sort of her spikiness particularly that you mentioned. I'm glad that that's in the memoir.
Mm. Well, but I'm far from a completist in terms of her work. I mean, I've probably only read 5, 6, 7 novels, and there are so many. What I hadn't realised actually until reading this memoir was, I knew she was a poet, but I hadn't quite appreciated how much this has shaped everything that she's done. So her very first works, published in the 1960s, was poetry. And what she writes about that's really interesting is the way that she uses poetry to crack open an idea. And so the work that she did on Alias Grace, for example, decades before she ever wrote that wonderful piece of historical fiction, she came across the research and the characters who she eventually wrote into the novel. But she started out by writing poetry about them. And she said this is what poetry does for her. It helps open up an idea. And that's what she's doing, I think, in this memoir. She's opening up the idea of her creativity and shaping it around elements of her personal life. I mean, she does entire swathes of Canadian history in a paragraph or two, and then she will stop on people and moments and work and relationships in a way that keeps on informing us about her ideas and how they work. And then she'll stop on things like her wild curly hair and her spiky demeanor and the way that her hair and her anger and her voice have also been judged over the years. And so all of that, there's a really interesting sort of tension and almost ambivalence at times about what elements of herself she wants to open up. Actually, it's her hair and her glare is how she describes it.
So is she honest with herself?
She's pretty fierce with herself and her own shortcomings, and she doesn't always name people who've done her wrong, but she does say, I guess she says, look, this is why you might write a memoir, to paint yourself in a glowy light and take down all of your enemies, and that's not a good enough reason to do it. And so she goes through all the reasons why she's resisted it. And actually the reason that I stopped at the end and haven't quite been able to bring myself to read the last 50 pages is that there's a lot in this book about her relationship with her partner Graham, who she was with for decades. You know, it was a real creative as well as life partnership. And at the end of the book, she's describing his dementia and his decline. And it is so beautiful and so moving and sort of heartbreaking that it got to this point where I thought, I can't keep reading this. I mean, I need to, but, you know, I'm going to come into the studio and I don't want to be all teary. It's beautifully, beautifully done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I guess I kind of expected that. Hardly a surprise. All right, well, that is called Book of Lives, A Memoir of Sorts by Margaret Atwood. Well, we've focused on 3 books today, but let's get a few more recommendations. Stuart and Hannah, let's hear what you've been reading. First to you, Stuart.
Probably the book that I've enjoyed most this year was Nico Stratus's book called The Dad Rock That Made Me a Woman. And Nico Stratus is a closeted trans woman living in the Yukon in the northwest of Canada. And she writes this incredible memoir about coming out and her world through records. So there's a chapter and specific albums. So there's chapters devoted to records by Wilco, Courtney Barnett, REM, Pearl Jam, The Waterboys. And it's completely riveting and fabulous. And also, look, I read Raya Elias's Harley Loco, which I thought was an incredible memoir about hairdressing and drugs and rock and roll in New York City and her background and everything like that. And that drew me to Elizabeth Gilbert's book, All the Way to the River. I must be the last person on the planet to read an Elizabeth Gilbert book, but I found her dissection of her relationship with Raya Ellis riveting. And finally, I've completely fallen for the detective novels written by Jonathan Ames, who was the creator of Bored to Death. And I'm just started the third one, which they all feature a investigator called Happy Doll. Real name, Happy Doll. And they're very contemporary. I mean, Happy Doll snorts lots and lots of cocaine whilst sorting out whatever mystery is in front of Happy Doll. Then he needs to come down. He takes heroin. You know, it's very hip, contemporary. They're incredibly readable, fabulous. I love all, well, I love the two that I've read, and I'm already completely hooked by the third one.
What about you, Hannah Kent? What have you been reading?
I just finished The History of Sound by Ben Shattuck, a short story collection, I think published last year, but sort of had a re-release because they've made a film of the eponymous story, which I think has just also been released. So I have, you know, very much the filmic tie-in cover, but it's beautiful. It's a collection of short stories which are nonetheless interconnected under the structure of a traditional folk song. I loved that. I love that premise, and the writing itself is gorgeous. It's set across, actually not unlike Helm, it's sort of these interconnected stories where you see glimmers and, you know, sort of the consequences of other stories as you continue throughout time. Really, really beautiful writing. I also really loved Waist Deep, which is by a Danish writer called Linnea Meyer Ernst, translated by Sherilyn Nicolette Helberg. And the premise is that five friends from back in university days gather together at a lakeside cabin for a week. And sort of as they're there relaxing, some of them have kids, all these sort of hidden stories of desire and disappointment and betrayal sort of emerge through multiple perspectives. And I normally really hate books of multiple perspectives because I find that inevitably one's going to be a lot, you know, one's going to be shine and the others are going to be less good. And so I always find them slightly uneven, but she does it so well. Often, you know, sometimes within the same paragraph, which I didn't even know you could do. But yeah, it's great. I really enjoyed it. And finally, also, got to reading Hot Milk by Deborah Levy, which has been on my to-read list for years. So I loved it. Of course I did. It was wonderful.
Good.
Quick question, what you might want to read next. I mean, Stuart, I've got Patti Smith's memoir ready to go, Bread of Angels. I'm really looking forward to reading that. That's got to be on your list, doesn't it?
It is sitting in a smallish pile by the bedside. I'm very keen to read it. Initially, I was going, another memoir from Patti Smith. I mean, I love Just Kids, less impressed by the books that came afterwards, and was swayed towards this by reading just a couple of paragraphs where she writes about her relationship with Fred Sonic Smith, the guitar player from the MC5, which was ostensibly the reason, you know, she stopped making records, moved to Detroit, became a mum. And that was very, very powerful and engaging. So I'm in for that. And I also do believe that there is quite an astonishing twist in this memoir about Patti Smith's...
she's not Bob Dylan's daughter, is she?
She's not Bob Dylan's daughter, no. But there is some question about who is her father that emerges.
Oh, really?
I don't think that's... I'm not going to give it away, but I have read that there's something that she found so confronting that she had to put this book away for a couple of years to process what she discovered before she could complete it.
Mm-hmm. Goodness me. Hannah, what about your to-be-read pile?
Oh, look, it's very, very high, which is how I like it just before the Christmas holidays. But I'm really excited to read Lily King's latest, Heart the Lover, which is probably the book which has been most recommended to me this year. I've loved her other books, so, yeah, I'm very excited for this one.
I'm writing that one down.
It's got a beautiful cover.
Doesn't it?
Thank you so much for joining us to talk books.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Hannah Kent's latest book is Always Home, Always Homesick, a love letter to Iceland. And her novel Burial Rites came in at number 6 on ABC Radio National's Top 100 Books of the 21st Century Countdown. I voted for it, Kate, actually.
Of course you did. It's a beautiful book. And Stuart Coop is a music writer and promoter whose latest book is Saffron Incorporated, The First King of the Cross and 50 Years of Sex, Murder, Music and Mayhem.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of The Bookshelf. Join us again next time because, yes, it's the annual Books of the Year edition, an absolute necessity if you're buying Christmas presents.
So I guess we need to start making those lists again. Cassie McCullough, I'm Kate Evans. See you all next time.
Yeah, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.